Nepo baby Jackson Holliday is finally making his way to the big leagues. Happy Wednesday, everybody.
I'm Jordan Schusterman. That's Jake Mintz making a joke about how Jackson Holliday didn't even earn it. He was just handed a spot in the big leagues. We're going to talk about all of that and more on this Wednesday edition of Baseball Barbercast.
Following in the footsteps of legendary Nepo babies like Barry Bonds and Ken Griffey Jr. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbercast, the only baseball podcast in the world that celebrates Jackson Holliday every day. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And it is really disheartening to see Jackson Holliday use his status as the child of a former big leaguer to propel himself to the big leagues, not on merit, but solely on his last name.
No, certainly not on his, 900 career minor league OPS or his unbelievable all around baseball skills. He's going to show up to Fenway Park or, he's going to show up to Camden Yards and be like, do you know who I am? My dad played in the big leagues. And he'll be like, okay, fine. We'll let you on the field, little boy. No.
Do you know who my dad is?
Do you know who my dad is? Hey, listen, I'm sure he's pulled that at times in his life. However, it is no longer necessary because Jackson Holliday is finally, it seems ridiculous to say finally, because this dude was born in December of 2003, but finally, he is a big leaguer. That is, of course, our main topic. On today's episode of Baseball Barbercast, it is great to see you, Jake. I understand you will be shipping up to Boston, as they say, to witness this debut, which is very exciting. We got this news on Tuesday night as we were both at a ballpark. I was in Cincinnati. I'll be back there today. You were at Yankee Stadium. And Jeff Passan with the news we've all been waiting for, that Jackson Holliday is coming to the big leagues.
I mean, I saw Jeff Passan tweeting about Jackson Holliday, and I thought he needed Tommy John surgery. But that's just the negative Nancy lens that I've been glancing through the last couple of days. Yeah. But this is momentous news. It is a big deal. So let's take a couple minutes to explain why. For those of you who are not familiar with Jackson Holliday, here's the rub. He is the number one prospect in baseball, shortstop, second base, middle infield type for the Baltimore Orioles. He was the number one overall pick in the 2022 draft as a high schooler out of Stillwater, Oklahoma. And he is, yes, indeed, the son of one Mr. Matt Holliday, who terrorized offenses for the better part of the 2000s and 2010s. They are very different types of players. But there is an argument that Jackson could end up with a comparable career. Jordan, what do people need to know about Jackson Holliday?
Yeah, so, we've had so much, baseball lineage kind of make their way and make an impact. We've talked about the juniors. We've seen versions of this, of course, guys like Bo Bichette, et cetera, sons of big leaguers who incredibly, their dads have already had incredibly successful major league careers. And the notion that they could, in fact, be even better, or that you could project that reasonably, is so exciting and so cool. Now, what's so incredible about Jackson Holliday, who, again, will be debuting this week at age 20, he just turned 20 in December, is while it's not surprising that Jackson Holliday is a major leaguer, that part, no one is shocked by that. And people who are around him, and you've talked about this before, but like, not just the advantages, in terms of access and literal experience being around major leaguers all the time is going to kind of breed an opportunity. And not to mention the talent you're going to naturally get by your dad being Matt Holliday. Jackson Holliday did prove something in a very exciting way over the last 2 years that should not really go unnoticed. Because what is so wild, and as I've followed the draft really, really, really closely over the last 4 or 5 years, is going back and looking at the final draft rankings for 2022, which again is not even 2 full years ago, right? And Jackson Holliday, who of course was very well known, coming up as an amateur, nobody, not a single outlet on draft day. And if I'm wrong, you can correct me on this. But from what I can check, none of the major 6, 7, 8 draft outlets had Jackson Holliday at number one on draft day. And that was because of Drew Jones. That was because of Tamar Johnson, Elijah Green. It was a stacked top of the high school class. But it is a reminder that even after his unbelievable senior season at Stillwater, there was still like, okay, like he's obviously a top 10 to top five pick, but like, is he obviously number one in the way that he is now in minor league baseball? And now he is, which is that is an incredible change that happened so quickly that suddenly we realized he was actually number one all along.
Just to be clear, you're talking about draft rankings and not a mock draft.
Correct. But
that's an important distinction, I think.
Yeah, but it goes hand in hand, right? Because it speaks to when the Orioles did select Jackson Holliday, it wasn't a shocking pick, right? Because we figured he would be in that mix, but it was not what most people were expecting because of Drew Jones, because of Tamar Johnson, because of Brooks Lee, who was also in that class, and we thought the Orioles might go in that direction. And the reason why I bring that up is because of how why we get to this day here, less than 2 years later, where the Baltimore Orioles, amidst this now loaded team, get to add this player because they nailed it. And that is why that is such a big deal, that they had Jackson Holliday number one, and they were right.
But I actually think it's worth turning the clock back even further, Jordan, to, you know, a couple years before the draft, where obviously if you're Matt Holliday's son and you're on the showcase circuit, you are a known commodity, right? Scouts are going to see you and know about you. And, you know, as a sophomore and a junior, Holliday was a good, though not elite, prospect, right? He was like a second round, maybe back of the first type. Questions about the power, whether it would develop. People liked his glove at shortstop. But this was even like further back than that. I talked to Skip Schumacher about this last night, who's known the Holliday family forever. He said he went and saw Jackson Holliday play in the area code games as a sophomore, I believe, and was not impressed. And was like, he got one inning in the field and like two at bats. And like, this was not, even though his dad was Matt Holliday and he had every advantage in the world, this is not like a situation. This is not Bronny James, right? No.
Well,
where it was like, I mean, for a million reasons, it's not Bronny James. It's probably a bad cop. But like, Jackson Holliday was. Jackson Holliday was not the best 14-year-old baseball player on planet Earth, I guess, is the point that I'm trying to make, right? And that's just a good reminder that development at the high school level.
Yeah.
Is not linear, right? Like it takes time. These are children. But what Jackson Holliday has proved over the last 2 years in the minor leagues is like patience is a good thing. And now he is very much a man, even though he looks like a boy.
Well, and to be clear, two things on that. The first thing to be clear, like, okay, so then how good was he if he was the summer, even the summer before his senior year, he was still considered kind of back of the first. his high school stats. Junior or senior year. Mm. 40
Amazing.
Games. He hit .685.
The average, 89. That's what it is. Just you can't just say hit .685. Like OPS has become, you know, more popular.
Well, I'll give you that in a second. Yeah.
Yeah, but his batting average was .685.
Hit .685 in 40 games. That's 89 hits in 40 games. 17 home runs, 752 OBP, 1369 slugs. So that's a 21-21 OPS. And that is what was like, oh, okay, maybe you are a top five player. But like I said, there was
I'm almost
still,
surprised, Jordan, that he didn't get walked more than that.
I know. I always feel that way about like the top high school players. It makes no sense to me. But anyway, so that happens and like that vaults him into the top five conversation. But that's I just want to hammer that. It was not consensus that he was number one. And it's not that the Orioles were taking a risk taking Jackson Holliday, but it was that he was not the obvious pick in the way that Drew Jones was considered. Drew Jones, separate podcast. We're going to table that. But the point is Jackson Holliday is making his debut today and Drew Jones is not. So with that being said, like the Orioles by nailing this have now added, now let's fast forward to today, right? If Jackson Holliday was still an A-ball, we'd still be talking about the Orioles having this unbelievably bright future. Instead, he blitzes his way through the minor leagues. He makes every adjustment you could possibly ask him for. Sure, has he still not faced that much left-handed pitching? But this is the nature of when you're this good, right? It's the same thing with Evan Carter. It's like, well, I can blame him for having not faced left-handed pitching. Well, that's because he's so good that he's already in the big leagues and he's 5 years old. So is that a bad thing? No, we just have to see what happens.
I'm also very skeptical that he's going to be overwhelmed by the major leagues, more than most 20-year-olds, where I would say that the risk, the downside, the potential downside of calling up a guy who's too young is that they get to the big league level and the environment kind of swallows them and they are unable to make those adjustments necessary for their development at the big league level because of all the other stuff it means to be at the big leagues, right? Where winning is the priority and your lifestyle is like, none of that is going to frazzle Jackson Holliday. And so while he may need to make strides with left on left pitching, like he's just going to do that against, I don't know, like Martin Perez or whatever.
Right. But again, just to look back at what he did last year, you know, playing at four different levels of the minors and improving it. And the Orioles clearly admitting like, yep, nope, he's all right. He's ready. Move him on up, move him on up, move him on up.
We don't like to do comps. They're hard. Every player is their own thing. And Holliday is a really good example of that. But what I think is important to emphasize about him as a player, he does not have an elite tool, right? There is no 80 on the 20 to 80 scale on his scouting report. There's not, and that's okay. I'm not denigrating him. 80s are rare. There may not even be, there's probably a 70. There may not be a 70, right? Like the reason Jackson Holliday is superb as a prospect is he does everything extraordinarily well, right? So what that means is he is going to have a huge war, but it's going to be because he's like a 135 OPS plus guy who plays incredible defense at second base or third base and is dynamic on the bases. And like, that's where the value is going to come from. Like, he's not going to hit 60 home runs. This is not Aaron Judge, right? He is not going to steal, you know, 55 bases like Bobby Witt, right? I don't think there is going to be like a single number on the stat sheet that is going to be eye-popping, especially early. He is the sum of his parts in a way that like you can tell when you watch him in person that he's incredibly good, right? And there is still a lot of power and there's still a lot of speed. But I just think it is important to kind of understand the type of player that we are about to see. This is not, you know, Aaron Judge, Pete Alonso, rookie year. Is he going to get to 50 homers? This is not what that's going to be, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I've kind of asked around about this too, you know, as he was, you know, going through the minors as quickly and just thinking about projecting that stat line and the kind of player. A name that came up is Chase Utley in terms of the production, right? Like peak Chase Utley, who was getting on base, you know, 37, 38% of the time. He was drawing a lot of walks. I mean, the fact that Holliday drew 100 walks last year as a 19-year-old playing four levels of minor league baseball is pretty wild. And to me, that's where the other thing that it makes me think of is a conversation that, you know, I just had with Russ about Mookie Betts and about guys like him and Jose Ramirez, where, you know, the game power is actually more than the raw power. You know, you might not see Jackson Holliday hitting balls 115, but it doesn't matter because he can tap into it better than most people. And that's why I think that the hit tool might end up being a 70, if not an 80, right? Because of what he's already been able to show. So that's where, but I agree with you. I think that the stats and the physical tools aren't necessarily going to jump off the screen in the same way. But for an Orioles team that already has so much offensive infrastructure in place, and who am I to doubt that he's, that it can't, you know, grow into even more pop or closer to 30 or 40. I don't know. It's still so early, so there's no reason to really cap him. But generally, I agree with your assessment.
So how he fits into the Orioles roster and how he fits into the Orioles kind of arc is interesting, because if there's not that much pressure on him relatively, right? There could have been a situation where Jackson Holliday got to the big leagues and the Orioles were like dependent on him to hit, to pop immediately, you know? Jackson Holliday could be a bust, okay? He could come up and just go poof and be nothing, and the Orioles would still be okay, right? And I think that that's not something Jackson Holliday is thinking about at all. I guarantee it. That is not something any professional athlete thinks about. That being said, I do think it is relevant because, you know, the last two seasons, the Orioles have had a top prospect, the top prospect in baseball, come up and debut. Adley Rutschman 2 years ago, Gunnar Henderson last year. And so the organization and the fan base and the coaching staff, they know how to handle this thing, that is about to happen in a way that I think is very unique and special, and I believe will make Holiday's transition to the big leagues even easier than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, well, I agree with that, but you know, mentioning Adley and Gunnar also is a reminder of how high the bar is in terms of immediate production, and why I am interested to see what kind of impact he can make, you know, where he is in the lineup. Because my understanding is, again, you know, developed as a shortstop, Gunnar Henderson is a shortstop. That's not changing, yes, at least in the immediate future. And correct, so Jordan Westberg and Ramon Urias and I guess Jorge Mateo have kind of been rotating through second and third. How do you kind of see his playing time shaking out in the early going? Because obviously he's coming up to play, right? He's not coming up to play a bench role. He's going to be starting every day at one or a couple of these positions.
So I get the sense that the Orioles believe more in Westberg than Urias right now. I could see a situation where Urias plays against lefties, just because he's much better against left-handed pitching, even though both he and Westberg are right-handed. So I think what will happen is that Westberg is going to play third and Holiday is going to play second and Henderson will play short. That's my expectation. I think the guy who gets bumped off the roster is almost certainly Tony Kemp, who, yep, they acquired like right at the end of spring, made an unbelievable catch yesterday. I don't know if you saw that, but like a spectacular snack.
Love Tony Kemp.
And the Tony Kemp Orioles era will live on forever as the placeholder for Jackson Holiday. And then I would expect like Mateo will stay on the bench and kind of float around and get his at-bats as he goes. He's also much better against lefties. So I could see a scenario, even though they want Holiday to face left-handed pitching and develop, it would make sense, like if you're trying to win a baseball game, that you could see, you know, Westberg at third, Mateo at second, Holiday on the bench. I think they'll try and give him as much playing time as possible, especially because the rest of this team is so strong. But you're right. Like, he's going to play. He's not up here to watch his friends.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, and, you know, we'll see if they, you know, cycle through Mountcastle DH and O'Hearn playing first. They have some mixing and matching that they can do. But I will say the last thing I want to mention, this is more big picture Orioles, is... I tweeted this last night. I mean, this Norfolk team, which we sort of saw coming based on how the spring trainings that we saw from guys like Kyle Stowers, you know, and Kerstad and Kowser. I know Kowser's up in the big leagues now, right? But the fact that it also was going to include Holiday, it was also going to include Kobe Mayo, one of their other top prospects. The numbers they're putting up are laughable. Now, are they going to have a team OPS of 1,200 for the whole season? Probably not. But like, there's more on the way, and it is going to be interesting when we start to shuffle in that next wave, because you can only OPS, you know, 1,200 at AAA for so long before, you know, the big league team's going to try and give you a chance or trade you for something.
So I generally hate the sports conversation of, could this college team beat this pro team, right? It is never true. It is never true. Could the UConn men's basketball team take on the Pistons? No. They would get worked and waxed. It is the best player on the best college basketball team, like, would be like pretty good on the worst NBA team. That's just the best player, right? And same thing in football. Like, could Alabama beat the Jaguars? Like, get out of here. However, I think that the Norfolk Tides lineup is better than big league lineups, certain big league lineups right now.
I don't think I agree with that. I think that they could fake it. I think
for a short
of the lineup,
time. Right. Great.
The
point.
Lineup, you could show up and watch this lineup in a major league uniform and not be like, what's something's up? But the problem with these conversations, again, is just like, this is an incredibly talented lineup. This is why I'm bringing it up, right? I didn't mention Norby, Peyton Burdick, who I love, and I hope I get to talk about more of this season at some point. But like, to me, again, every single one of these conversations, and I feel like the reason why we fall into it more easily with baseball is because it's not as much of like a size and physicality thing. Whereas like so much about the discussion in football and basketball is like, well, this is stupid. Like they're literally not large enough to compete at the highest level, even if we're talking about SEC.
Baseball, the
or whatever.
Age and physicality gap is much smaller. And like the one reason that it's always more susceptible to it, I'm susceptible to it, is like I look at their roster and I see Taron Vavra, big leaguer. Nick Maton, played in the big leagues. Ryan McKenna, big leaguer, right? And so it's not just, you know, nine players who are not our children. Like they're you could put one of those three guys batting eighth in a big league lineup and you'd be like, oh yeah, like that's
fine. And that's why I said like you could fake it and like these guys are gonna go on to become all stars and like these are great players. This is how I feel about whenever we go out of our way to make absurd hyperbole. Listen, we can talk, we're gonna do this in a little bit. We can talk about how much the White Sox suck without saying that they would lose to a AAA team. You can do both of those things. They can be separate conversations.
Right.
It's fine.
Like, is Paul Skenes an all-star in the big leagues right now? Like,
right, when he's pitching against Western Michigan.
Like, probably not. That's okay. He's still really good. You're right, Jordan. Right. You've talked me off this ledge. Anyway, Jackson Holliday debuting later today, 7 o'clock start against the Red Sox in Boston. I will be getting in my 2013 Toyota Prius in about 45 minutes to head up there. And I am incredibly excited. Let's take a quick break. And when we return, we are going to fly through some news and some notes. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. How's your elbow, buddy?
I feel fine. I know that since we talked on Monday, I actually threw again with my brother on the eclipse day, right as the moon was moving over to block out the sun. I was like, this is a great day. I'm just going to stand outside and play catch. And my elbow still feels fine. Unfortunately, since we spoke on Monday, we've got another wave of, hey, you know that pitcher you really like watching? He's not going to be pitching for a while. Again, the range of these is there is a spectrum here. There is the like, oh, he's done, right? TJ Antone, horrible news. He's getting a third Tommy John surgery. Then we have JoJo Gray with the Nationals.
The third one is like, free.
Third, hopefully. I hope
the Tommy John punch card.
Yeah, this is the last thing we want to be, you know, racking up rewards on. But, you know, we have, and then JoJo Gray, who's dealing with some elbow stuff. He says it's you know, muscular. We'll see if this is, he can be back. But then Framber Valdez gets scratched at the last possible second. We have Nick Pivetta going on the IL with elbow stuff. So again, some of these guys will maybe be out for the year. Some of these guys will be back in a couple of weeks. We'll see. The point is, it's still in the news. And I know you got to listen to Gerrit Cole kind of speak about this at Yankee Stadium recently. And I'm sure that he's, we've always said this, if you've listened to us for a while, like Gerrit Cole's a baseball player that when he speaks, I listen. And it seems like this was a good example of that.
Yeah, he's just so thoughtful when he opens his mouth and considered with what he says. There were a couple different takeaways from what happened on Monday at Yankee Stadium. So, you know, Cole, who is himself coming back or attempting to come back from an elbow issue, he threw for the first time from 60 feet on Monday. And so he like walks into the locker room and he puts on his cap and he like stands in front of his locker knowing that like he's about to provide the I'm Gerrit Cole and I threw a baseball today update, right? And he does that and he talks about that for like 2 minutes. And then someone inevitably asks him about the kind of wave of injuries, elbow injuries that we've had in the game. And it just kind of turns into a town hall for like 20 minutes, right? He's just holding court, answering people's questions about it. And I was just struck by like, besides anything he said, just the level of, you know, I understand that he is a very rich man and that like the part of the job is talking to us. I get that. But just the way that Cole thinks about these things and like chooses his words carefully to try and provide insight is really appreciated to see. The one takeaway before I get into like what actually he said, he did not seem to lump himself in with the wave of injuries, which I thought was particularly interesting. He did not say like we or us. Like he was talking about how he's been able to stay healthy throughout his career, you know, and that was fascinating. And maybe I'm reading too much into it. That like made me feel more optimistic about his path back, that he doesn't consider himself to be like a Tommy John guy, right? And or he's just like totally detached from it and can't even consider himself in that way. What, either way, it was just very interesting, the read that I got on it. Like, one person asked, like, how have you been able to stay so healthy? And like, he didn't even mention the fact that he is hurt right now.
Right. Well, that's why, especially now with all these injuries and to have guys in limbo, you know, we're I don't know what the Kyle Bradish status is, right? That's someone who's seemingly working his way back.
I believe he is on a minor league rehab start. I think he did it either yesterday or today. He's okay. Going to make a start in the minor leagues. Yeah.
So we've seen versions of that. I know Matt Brash with the Mariners is in a similar spot. Of course, it's a little bit different as a reliever. But yeah, I mean, to your point, like, it's just Cole is in a very unique situation because it's so sensitive, and yet he is able to look big picture and offer his, because that's the thing. Like, you're literally talking about something that there's, you know, a chance he could end up getting Tommy John, you know, in a couple of weeks. And it's like, he's able to still zoom out and assess and give some reasonable opinions, even if some of them are a little strange coming from a guy who might end up getting cut open.
So if you want kind of the whole rundown, I wrote about this at Yahoo Sports the other day, but I guess my major takeaways was he just seemed really disheartened about the fight between the union and the league about it, which was striking to me because Cole has been such a strong union guy throughout his career, and to show any level of criticism towards the union and the statement they made, I thought that was interesting. However, he reserved much more ire for Rob Manfred and the rule changes, just saying that these rule changes and how they interact with arm injuries potentially does not put players at the forefront of the conversation. It does not prioritize the health of pitchers above other things. And he thinks, obviously, understandably, that's a big mistake because people want to go to the yard and watch Shane Bieber and Shohei Ohtani and Spencer Strider. And that in some ways is more important in his mind than carving 20 minutes off the game. Now, I don't know if I agree with that or disagree with that, but it is certainly an interesting perspective to hear it coming from him. The other takeaway I had is, right, if anyone is going to have insight into this, it's Gerrit Cole. And the amount of times he said the phrase, I do not have the answers, was revealing. And a great reminder that even the people who know don't know. And I think that is, in a weird way, the first step, acknowledging that the answers are not out there right now for us to be definitive on. There's evidence that certain things have contributed and people have theories, right? And guys like Gerrit Cole definitely have, you know, certain inklings, and he alluded to some of them. But I think that just Gerrit Cole going out there and saying, yeah, I don't have the answers, is the first step to figuring out the problems, like the causes, so that then we can start to solve them.
Yep. I think that is totally, totally fair. And yeah, I mean, we're just going to keep... This is the other thing, just to remind her big picture about this stuff, is that like, it feels terrible right now, and it does feel like we're losing an unbelievable number of top-tier starting pitchers. Every year, this is the time. You know, we're going to get through this wave, and not that there are guys that aren't going to blow out in June or July. It is feeling... Now, that we shouldn't forget about it, though, right? That's the other thing, is this needs to keep... We might not be talking about it every week on Baseball Barbercast. I hope we're not. Not that it's not important. But at the same time, it needs to be an issue that is still prioritized by the league and the players.
To keep things in the Bronx, though, a little bit of positivity. I was at Carlos Rodon's first home start of the year last night, and he looked superb. Probably his best start in pinstripes since he joined the Yankees last winter on a big contract. His first season in the Bronx was an absolute stinker. If you listen to this show, you know that we've been friends with Carlos for like a decade at this point, which is insane and hilarious. And he was just so unequivocally ass in 2023. Yep. I mean, and he knows that. And so, like, to see him go out there yesterday and shove, yes, it was against the Marlins, who suck. It was still a huge step in the right direction because of how he went about dismantling the Marlins. Like, when Carlos is at his best, he can afford to be liberal with his fastball location. Like, he can just throw four-seamers on the outer half to righties and just, like, get foul balls and swings and misses, whether it's up or down, right? And that lets him get ahead in counts, and then he can use the slider. And he's back to that, right? That's what he looked like last night. And now he has the cutter that he can throw in on the hands. And he's got the changeup working much better way to like, he just looked like a rejuvenated version of himself. And that's got to be encouraging for Yankees fans and for the Yankees.
Yeah. And I want to stick on that theme because let's just work this fun fact in here because I want to talk about the Marlins. The Marlins fun fact. And then I want to talk about Tyler Glass now before we move on to the Red Sox here quickly. This one, not very fun if you're a Marlins fan, but it is a fact.
Funny fact. Can we call this a funny fact?
Yeah, I think that qualifies. This was, of course, shown on the Yankees broadcast and not on the Marlins broadcast, because why would you show this if you were on the Marlins broadcast? Of course, Giancarlo Stanton facing his former team this week. That feels like so long ago that he was on the Marlins. But when Giancarlo Stanton was on the Marlins, what was he doing, Jake? He was hitting home runs, right?
He was hitting them out, baby.
He was hitting them out. And he was hitting so many of them out that somehow, some way, even though he has not played there since 2017, his 59 home runs for the Marlins in 2017 remain the most that any Marlins hitter has launched since then, not in any individual season, but in totality.
Most home, so like the stat is right, most home runs for Marlins hitters since the beginning of 2017. Giancarlo Stanton is the leader of that
still
group,
number one.
Still number one, despite having played there just one season. Brian Anderson got oh so close, ripping 57 long balls over fences throughout this great country, but not close enough because Stanton at 59. And Jazz, just to say, Jazz Chisholm will solve this quandary this year. He's at 55. Like, he will get to 60 this year. I feel pretty good about it. That being said, it's just a great example of just it perfectly captures the last 6 years of Marlins baseball.
I have lamented the 2020 shortened season many times and how goofy the stats are. However, that season and not playing 100 games has essentially afforded this fun fact surfacing in 2024. And for that, I am grateful. Now, again, if you showed me this fun fact in 2022, it still would have been wild. But in this case, that it has lasted this long, it is very impressive. Quickly on the theme, you said Carlos looked awesome. The offense, Marlins, obviously not very impressive. Tyler Glass now just keeps looking better and better and better. And if this is the year of all years that Tyler Glass now throws 200 innings, that would really be something to behold. But he is sure looking like he wants to throw 200 innings, or at least, you know, way more than he ever has in his career. Last night, striking out 14 Minnesota Twins. And while that is impressive, because if you strike out 14 big league batters and walk none of them, that is impressive no matter what. And throwing seven innings, I mean, he just looked amazing. 88 pitches. Well, what is this? This is a crazy, crazy fun fact here. This is fun. This is not just funny. 14 strikeouts on 88 pitches. The only pitcher to do, that's basically the first time that's happened since pitches have been tracked since 1998, to strike out 14 with fewer than 90 pitches. That is a ridiculous example of how efficient he has been. And just why, I mean, I retweeted, you know, the Dodgers, you know, K-reel of this. This is peak Glass now. I mean, this is what it looks like. When you see this fastball that is essentially just, it's not just that he's throwing, you know, 96, 97. The plane that which it just kind of teleports to the mitt, to the top of the zone, is unbelievable. Not to mention that he's working with 270 or 80 grade breaking pitches.
It looks like it's moving through something thinner than air. Like, yes. Right? Like, you know, when it's humid out and people will say, oh, it's like walking through split pea soup. Like, it's just like heavy, you know?
Yeah.
And when Glasnow throws it, it's like, it's different. It just like moves through space different. And it's just a great, like, that is what elite raw stuff looks like. And obviously, I mean, not that the Rays didn't know what they were doing. They clearly do. But just like the Dodgers clearly have helped him kind of hone some things and some, right? And it's just fully operational. Yes. And holy crap.
Yeah. So I've been high on Glass now. I've been super excited to see what this was going to look like, and it could not have been going as good as it's been, as smooth as we could possibly hope. That said, as far as early season trends go, the Minnesota Twins are hitting 181 as a team, Jake. Their OPS, now listen, when we talk about bad offenses in 2024 through 2 weeks, the Marlins currently have the worst OPS. The White Sox, who are being designed to be one of the worst teams in baseball, terrible. Seattle Mariners, who are a complete farce of an offense right now, currently sit in fourth. But to see the Minnesota Twins down there hitting 181, 279, 314 is troubling. I am troubled. Is that okay? Can I be troubled?
I mean, Royce Lewis is slashing 1,000, 1,000, 2,500 in two plate appearances.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. He's doing a lot of the heavy lifting. Think about how much worse the OPS would be without those two Royce Lewis plate appearances.
I mean, I understand your concern, but, you know, they have faced such vaunted pitching staffs as the Royals, who are okay, the Brewers, who are, and now the Dodgers. I am concerned in Cleveland. Yeah. I'm concerned about the Twins. I am not yet panic stations. I was the highest on this team heading into the year.
That's why I'm bringing it up. Yeah, I'm not calling you out.
I appreciate
that. I'm just checking in on you. You know, this is me just like making sure you're doing okay. Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong. I don't think that Edward Julian will have a 30 OPS plus when it's said and done. I don't think Carlos Santana will have a 25 OPS.
I don't think so either. Yeah.
I'll take the over on all these. Correa has looked great. Buxton's starting to figure some things out. Let me say this. I have bigger worries than the Twins offense.
As you should. Yeah. I'm just saying, as far as like small sample depths that one offense can go, this is a pretty impressive collection of batting averages that start with one. Speaking of are we concerned? Let's talk about the Boston Red Sox, Jake.
I'm concerned about Trevor Story's shoulder. Okay, I'm very concerned. Let's just get this out of the way. What a freaking bummer. What a brutal bounce. This is a guy who missed time with Tommy John surgery. He's battled tons of injuries since joining the Red Sox. By all accounts, is like a great clubhouse guy who works his ass off and has just a freak injury, laying out for a ball in the hole at shortstop, rolls on his shoulder the wrong way, lands on it, and it's just surgery done, out for the year. Just so brutal.
Yeah. And, you know, coming into this season, you talk about clubhouse guy, like this is someone who was working with, especially over the offseason, with, you know, Tristan Cassis and Vaughn Grissom, some of these younger players, you know, he was ready to kind of assume that leadership role. Obviously, when they signed him initially, it was like, well, what is this? Why is he the shortstop we're signing? What is going on? He's replacing Bogarts. Oh my gosh, this guy sucks. Again, injuries are injuries. I think Trevor Story is just, it's so unfortunate, and now is going to put him in a really difficult spot. Now, I will say it is related. It doesn't seem like we're likely going to see him again this season. Maybe we will at the end of the year. But it is related to two other Red Sox. It's just a lot happening in Red Sox world right now. And, you know, when I mentioned the injury earlier this week, I mentioned the name David Hamilton because he is one of their, you know, upper level infield depth prospects, you know, not Marcelo Meyer. But I think it's really related to the other bit of Red Sox news, which is that they extended Sedan Rafaela for an 8-year, $50 million, you know, early pre-arb extension, prospect who, one of the more interesting prospects, you know, I would say in the game, one of the more, I would say, both versatile, volatile, and just people have divisive, I would say. He's the kind of prospect with the kind of approach that he has, which is swinging everything with his physical tools that he has, with his ability to play center field, ability to play shortstop. It'll be interesting to see if they start to give him more time there or if they keep him in center field. Either way, it's someone that they're clearly invested in and kind of see that those skills, because this is a situation where it seemed like they were ready. The way Cora talked about him in spring, they were ready to let him play, and that's clearly was going to be the case whether they extended him or not. But now they're invested. He's clearly a core piece of their offense moving forward. Where he fits in, if they choose to use that flexibility to put him at shortstop, I'm really curious to see. But obviously, it's going to be more important to see how he develops as a hitter. But he's a player I'm going to be watching really closely this year for sure.
One other Red Sox thing to note, the Tim Wakefield ceremony before the game yesterday was really touching and heartfelt. Wakefield, who passed away over the offseason. And then 1 month after that, about a month after that, his wife, Stacy, passed away also from cancer. And the Red Sox had the entire 2004 team, except for worst person on earth, Curt Schilling, come out to honor Tim Wakefield and had his daughter throw out the first pitch. And it just looked like a very emotional moment where, you know, I could never begin to imagine the pain and hurt that that family is feeling. But it must offer some sort of comfort and relief to have like a whole stadium giving you some sort of a hug. And so that was just for those of you who haven't seen it, just go back and watch some of that. And then, you know, a lot was made out of the Red Sox decision to, I guess it was not extend an invitation to Curt Schilling or for Curt Schilling to deny the invitation. Like that's the, obviously the best thing Schilling, who revealed to the public that Wakefield had cancer in the first place, which is just an unforgivable, like human thing to do to someone that you presumably care about. And so to not have Schilling in attendance was just like kind of a big relief that we didn't have to endure what would have been a incredibly uncomfortable, unfortunate situation. So, you know, thoughts out to the Wakefield family and to, you know, Red Sox Nation as a whole. I thought that whole ceremony was handled incredibly well. From the Red Sox to the White Sox. The Chicago White Sox are not good. And this is kind of very slowly starting to dawn on them, even though it dawned on us a couple years ago. They have already lost to injury. They're presumably the three best hitters, Eloy Jimenez, Yoan Moncada, and Luis Robert Jr. are all on the IL right now. And that has kind of left this skeleton crew to fend for itself against major league pitching. But what we want to focus on is how the Chicago White Sox chose to handle the wonder and majesty of Monday's eclipse.
Yes. And of course, they were in Cleveland, where that was a real hub of eclipse activity as one of the major cities in the path of totality. And they embraced it, right? They obviously moved the home opener back. Both teams were seen. I mean, most of the people on both teams were very much involved, and the White Sox social account was posting videos of, here's Paul DeJong, you know, noted scientist dork, you know, talking about how much he loves the eclipse and is in awe of this. So everyone was in. Everyone was in.
The whole energy to me felt like a minor league game on July 4th, where after the game, like both teams and their families like sit out front of the dugout and watch the fireworks. Mm-hmm. It was that type of communal experience on a baseball field where it was cool. Like, it was cool to say, like, I was at Yankee Stadium for it and not in the path of totality at all. And it was still kind of cool. And so to be in Cleveland for it, I could only imagine. However, not every Chicago White Sox player was swooned by this once in a generation occurrence.
So this is just a great example of baseball people taking their level of intensity and focus kind of beyond the level of maybe what the public actually expects from them, right? So I think that there's an inclination from players to make sure that they always tell you, you know, how hard they're working and how seriously they take their job. And that's good. That's fine. I have no problem with that. We're not going to tell you to, you know, not care about your job. However, you know, before the game, it's like, hey, Pedro Grifol, you're going to go see the eclipse. This is not going to happen for a long time. This is very rare to be able to be in a place with its path of totality, whatever. Quote, I'll see videos of it, see what it looks like, but there's baseball. I shouldn't say that, but family and baseball, people don't believe it, but I live it. That's all that matters. So what he seems to be saying is, all I care about is baseball and my family. Nothing else is going to get in the way. Robbie Grossman gives a similar quote, which in the context of the 2024 White Sox is especially amusing. Robbie Grossman said, quote, I'm going to go through my routine and get ready for the game. If it was the off season, I would take a peek, but we're in season. This is my job. I'm accountable for being the best I can every day. I'm going to stick with that. Listen, Robbie Grossman, I appreciate that your work ethic and your drive to be a competent, good major leaguer is what is why many clubhouses around the game appreciate and adore you. However, it's going to be okay. We're going to be able to, it's, but this is the other part about this. BP is already arguably eyewash, right? I know that's a whole other discussion, but clearly players are like, yeah, if I'm going to be here and I get to look at something that I'm never going to see ever again in my life, yeah, I'm going to go do that and everything's going to be fine. And this tweet just absolutely killed me. And obviously there are a lot of people making fun of Grifol and Grossman, but this tweet from KThompson99, who quote tweeted the video of the White Sox, like most of the White Sox like enjoying the eclipse. He said, with the Sox, you can either suck and enjoy the eclipse, or you can be like Robbie Grossman and suck and not enjoy the eclipse. Give me Paul DeJong. Because
hell yeah,
Paul DeJong is in the video talking about how you know he's amazing. And I will say too, right, like I'll just give it. The other thing is the quote that part of Grifol's like, I'll see videos of it. I'm just telling you now. No video will come even close to doing it justice. And if you were lucky enough to be in the Pats hotel like I was,
yeah,
no video or picture that you will ever see will actually feel like what it actually felt like. And so apparently after Grifol admitted he did go take a look.
Okay.
So I appreciate that. I'm glad.
Yes. So Grifol did actually go and see it. And I was irked way more by the Grifol quote, though, than the Grossman mm-hmm. quote. Like mm-hmm. the Grifol thing to me, and this is coming from someone who is like, unhealthily involved in the sport of baseball.
Of course.
Like, you gotta have something else, dude. You gotta have something else. And not only have to have something else, you have to appreciate something else, right? Like a well-placed bunt is beautiful, yes. But so is a mountain vista, okay? Mm-hmm. So is the moon covering the sun. That is amazing. Like, I admittedly was somewhat underwhelmed by my eclipse experience because I'm in New York and I did not get to really experience it, right? And for Grifol to be in Cleveland and to poo-poo this because he's got to prepare for his club to get freaking waxed, okay, and have four hits and get shut out, like, enough, dude. Maybe think about something else. Like, loosen up just a smidge.
That's the thing.
Please. What?
Especially if you're going to manage the worst team in baseball. It's like, for his sake, like, dude, this could be one of the highlights of your season is being able
enjoy
to experience
life.
This with your players. With
enjoy
your players,
life.
Go out there. Look at how much Paul DeJong is geeking out. Like, this is adorable. I love this. Yeah. So, anyway, White Sox, hey, they won yesterday. They scored 7 whole runs, which is like,
yeah.
How did they score 7 runs? That is like, oh, I didn't even know that was allowed. I don't even think the Mariners have done that yet this year.
First hit of the year for Robbie Grossman. So the prep, I guess, is starting to work. I like Robbie Grossman. I'm fine about that. Last topic, and then we'll bid you adieu. The Pittsburgh Pirates, who have had a particularly hot start, they look, I'm buying. I've decided I'm buying, especially on the pitching side. They did blow it. In pretty devastating fashion yesterday in a matinee game against the Tigers, up 3-1 in the ninth with all-star closer David Bednar on the hill, and he blew the save, his third blown save of the young season. Last year, he did not blow his third save until August. Okay, it is April 10th. Now, that is definitely an area of concern because the Pirates need to get Bednar right, and it wasn't just that he blew the save. He looked frazzled and out of sorts. It is also worth mentioning that Bednar is a Pittsburgh area guy. He is beloved in that fan base. He is like sneaky, like recognizable in the city. Everyone knows someone who like grew up with David Bednar's like babysitter or something, whatever.
Just remember, you know, they traded for him, right? This wasn't a situation where they drafted the hometown kid. For them to trade for him, you know, from San Diego and for him to turn into one of the best closers in baseball, which is what he's been for the last few years. He has been unflappable. Now, for Pirates teams that haven't been very good, so we haven't necessarily noticed, but he's been a 2-time All-Star. Right. He led the NL in saves last year. He's been everything you could possibly hope for. The David Bednar story has been outstanding. He dealt with some injuries this spring, clearly has not looked right, already, as you mentioned, already blown a few saves. And after what happened yesterday, he was getting some boos from Pirates fans. Had a lot of boo discourse on here, right? My first instinct, we're always going to be pretty much always going to be anti-boo, but you know, this
unless
is a situation
you did
where,
crimes, you did
okay,
crimes.
I know, thank you. I know you always say that. You're like, yes,
crimes,
people that did crimes, yep.
Crimes and adultery. You yep. can boo.
Sure. But I will say that, and this is crazy, and we're going to get to why we want to talk about this, which is his teammate defending him. You know, to me, it is also a sign of like the Pirates fans are they're now like, we're the first place. Like, we got to hold our players accountable. We got to we have a standard now here in Pittsburgh.
We're trying to win, which we boo.
It's
right?
Like, this matters. Right. Exactly. And I was like, OK, like that's a little bit different than like the Chris Bryant booing that we talked about recently. But for David Bednar, of all people, to be the one that you're directing your ire at, as we're going to talk about here, is just ridiculous. Like, come on, people.
I think Phillies fans proved last year, Jordan Boone doesn't work, cheering does. And I think like David Bednar is not the guy to boo. Like, yeah, he was someone who was holding your hand through the darkness, and it's like, yes, not his fault. Like, he wasn't right in spring, yes, and he's going to be okay. Like, I have faith in David Bednar. So what happens is, in the post game interview in the clubhouse, where, you know, all the media gather around Bednar, hey, what went wrong tonight? Da, 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 da. Rowdy Tellez, the first baseman for the Pirates, who they signed over the winter, basically like hops into the scrum, and before Bednar can say anything, says, like, backs Bednar up and says, we love this guy, he's going to be okay. I thought what the fans did today was unacceptable. We can't be booing this guy. He's a Pittsburgh icon, a Pittsburgh legend. And you can like see Bednar is like almost tearing up, right? Like, he's like clearly getting emotional.
Yeah.
And it was a very rare and unique thing. That's the type of thing you usually would get someone saying to a reporter off the record or off of camera or like when asked about it. But for Tellez to unprompted hop in and defend his teammate, that's the type of thing that like, I cannot tell you how far that goes in the room, how much respect that gives someone like Tellez, how much that is going to be appreciated by Bednar. Because Bednar can't go out and say, I didn't like that the fans booed me, right? Mm-hmm. Then he's going to get criticized for that. But for Tellez to go out and say it, I thought was just incredibly tactful and empathetic and thoughtful and rare. And I think that's kind of why it stuck out and stood out with me.
And that's Tellez, who, you know, just got there, right? And someone who has already understood, you know, what David Bednar means to Pittsburgh. And listen, I mean, this is just, I say this a million times every season, closing is closing. The best closers in the world are going to poop their pants, a few times a year. And sometimes that all happens in 1 week. And what will happen now is he'll probably rattle off 10 saves in a row, you know, without allowing a base runner, because that's what happens with even the best closers. We're already dealing with small samples in the early going here. That is the nature of assessing relief pitching. So, it's unfortunate, but hey, I love David Bednar too, and I hope that he can get back. It'll be cool when he kind of gets back out there and closes down a game, because the Pirates, let me just leave you on this, Jake. This is how we'll end the show. Just being around the Reds and Brewers yesterday, I'll be there again today. NL Central.
The door is open, baby.
Yes, that's kind of what I'm getting at, but just like, I truly believe that this NL Central is just about the hardest to project from a top to bottom division that I can really remember. And the Pirates' hot start is only exacerbating that. It is a situation where I can make legitimate arguments for every team to finish first and last. I can't remember anything quite like this. And sure, you could say, oh, the Central's always been mid and it's always been a toss, whatever. Like, that's been true. Of course, this division has trended in that way. But this is going to be a really fascinating year in that division. It ain't always going to be pretty, but I can't wait to see where it goes.
I'm going to give you this opportunity. I picked the Cubs and you picked the Cardinals, right? Mm. Let's give each of us the opportunity every week for the entire season to change our pick until we're cooked. So I'm sticking with the Cubs. I still feel good about the Cubs. Do you feel any better or worse about any of these teams?
Well, listen, I want to end the podcast. We could do a whole thing, but this could be a good Wednesday tradition. At the end of every Wednesday, we just say, where are we at on the NL Central? I'm not changing. Sonny Gray looks great. Cardinals, you know, Gorman homered. I'm sticking with the Birds for now, and we will review again next Wednesday.
I'll hang with the Cubbies. Jordan Schusterman, thank you for doing a podcast with me, your friend. We will be back on Friday morning. I will provide an eyewitness report of Jackson Holliday's debut. I'm excited to see that. Remember, you can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Some great emails. We are eventually going to do a dip into our bag and read some of those mail. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. Anything else to say, Mr. Schusterman?
Nope. Back to the ball yard for both of us, and we will talk to you all on Friday.